The sense of solemnity that attends Remembrance Sunday tells us something of the legacy of the First World War and its impact still on our own time. The horror of that conflict has been sharpened for us by the recurrence of military intervention and death in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and most recently by grotesque scenes of bombing homes, hospitals, and family life in Syria. Looking back to 1918, the biographer James Pope Hennessy describes with somber realism the euphoric mood on Armistice Day in London in 1918 when, in the damp, fog-laden evening, King George V and Queen Mary returned yet again to the balcony of Buckingham Palace to greet crowds that were louder, wilder, more vociferous than ever. Pope Hennessy notes that the King and Queen were, in fact, saluting a new world, he writes. They would have to learn that slowly, for themselves, just how disillusioned and how impatient that new post-war world might prove to be, with its driving wish for freedom from tradition and convention, whatever the cost. Pope Hennessy doesn't go on to explore one aspect of this new world that is nevertheless of interest, I think, to us as its inheritors, namely the sudden loss of a pattern of government that incardinated Christianity into its structures through the institution of monarchy. The bloody and tumultuous years of 1914 to 1918 brought to a rapid end the three historic imperial thrones of Austria, Germany, and Russia, together with the abolition of several smaller Palatinate states, many of which had nurtured the Reformation and with whom England was closely bound through its royal family. In Catholic Austria and Protestant Germany and Orthodox Russia, a centuries-old relationship between church and state was ruptured in the loss of its emblem, the sovereign. And interestingly, the national anthem in each of those monarchies used to begin with the word God, as indeed ours still does. But before I disappoint any of you who might belong to the monarchist league, or conversely, I offend any full-blooded republicans, I want to stress that I'm not utopian by nature and do not yearn romantically for any former dispensation of absolute power or applaud uncritically the constitution and state in Europe or in the United Kingdom. But I do want to take note of the convulsion that ended 1,000 years of history. And in that context, I want to acknowledge the disillusion and impatience that marked the beginning of the previous century, and which seems not to have dissipated as it's flowed into the present one. And I want to ask whether freedom from tradition and convention, whatever the cost, has actually improved the lot of every man and woman and child. Has it made us a happier nation? Do we stop to ask? The gospel that we've heard today begins to outline for us, I believe, what a world might look like that is freed from the destructive conventions of political and economic power. But it's a disturbing picture. And Capernaum, where this snapshot is taken, is a place that sees the opportunity for something amazing, but spectacularly chooses not to pursue it. Capernaum seems to be a place that lives with a deep inner conflict. Jesus will upbraid the town that has witnessed his teaching and ministry to the sick and outcast because they failed to respond to his mighty works with penitence and a change of lifestyle. He says, "If the mighty works done in thee had been done in Sodom, it would have remained until this day." The mighty works are the signs of healing and the forgiveness of sins, profound reconciliation. The crowds are drawn to Jesus because they find compassion in him. He is authentic, and as a result, he exudes authority, a fact that disturbs the leadership of the local religious politics. The self-interested and complacent resistance of the religious elite draws a formidable denunciation from Jesus, which is recorded both by Matthew and Luke. He says, "And thou, Capernaum, that which art exalted unto heaven, thou shalt be brought down to hell." This is powerful language about a dramatic reversal of fortunes that might appear to be in tune with the modern appetite for reversal, for freedom from tradition, overturning the past, whatever the cost, which Pope Hennessy described. But today's gospel points us to yet another detail about life in Capernaum that might both trouble and encourage us. Jesus recognizes the essential decency of the centurion who is stationed there. As a powerless, itinerant teacher, Jesus responds with humble acceptance to the courtesy and the evidence of graciousness and religious intelligence in a senior military officer in one of the most brutal regimes of human history. And St. Luke paints the picture with even greater detail. In his gospel, initially, the centurion does not himself approach Jesus out of respect, but sends elders of the Jews who tell Jesus that this centurion loveth our nation and he hath built our synagogue. Jesus recognizes the hallmark of authentic holiness in this person. He marvels at faith made explicit in word and behavior, if not yet articulated in him, Jesus, as the Son of God. And he asserts that this person, along with others from outside the confines of Israel, will indeed have a place in the kingdom of heaven, alongside the patriarchs Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Capernaum will fall apart, not merely because of its resistance to the evidence that Jesus is Emmanuel, God with us, but because its intelligentsia, the shaper of popular opinion, saw in their own centurion the evidence of real virtue and a genuine capacity for something like holiness, but still failed to undergo that change of heart that is conversion to the gospel. And this is a change of heart which rejoices generously because centurions and tax collectors and sinners can find admission to the banquet of heaven. And because prostitutes and little children understand its dynamics of love, of recovery, of delight. And this disturbs the complacent religious establishment. The impatience and disillusionment observed on Armistice Day 1918 have indeed continued all too prominently in our national life. But this must not deflect us as Christians today from our public articulation of the gospel vision for a society in which contentment, meaning, and joy can flourish. In 2010, speaking in Westminster Hall, Pope Benedict asked us as a nation this question about our life. Where is the ethical foundation of political choices to be found? And he went on to observe that religion is not a problem for legislators to solve, but a vital contributor to the national conversation. And a little after that, we celebrated the Queen's Diamond Jubilee. And rightly, the then Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, hosted a reception for one of Europe's surviving Christian monarchs. And at that reception, he observed that communities are united not by law alone, but by a common language of affinities and symbols. And the Queen responded to this Lambeth Palace reception with her own speech for faith leaders by making reference to the beautiful sacred objects and holy texts that are the patrimony of the world's great faith traditions. These observations take us back to the centurion who built a synagogue in Capernaum. He understood that social cohesion is formed in vital ways through the potency of religious symbol and sacred text. And today, cultures that prided themselves on having moved on at any cost from attachment and attention to religion are being forced to reconsider its potential for cohesion and the disintegration that can follow from its denial. The Queen concluded her speech by noting that the role of the Church of England is not to defend Anglicanism, but to protect the free practice of all faiths in this country. From a sovereign who has made public her own personal adherence to the Christian faith, this is a bold statement. But it resonates with a confidence in Jesus Christ, the way, the truth, and the life, and the generosity of spirit that he himself exemplifies in the gospel, in his vision of the kingdom, in which those from outside find a place with the patriarchs and the chosen ones. We hear consistently of the hope for a better future that sustained those whom we commemorate today, who died in two world wars and subsequent conflict. When you go home, tell them of us and say, for their tomorrow we gave our today. A common epitaph on war memorials. In our own day, let the Church's honouring of their death be the sound of a voice that speaks for everything Capernaum rejected. The kingdom in which all virtue finds its reward, in which all nations find a home, and in which all men and women and children find life and dignity. Amen.